The Supreme Court's landmark 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision ended segregated schooling in the United States and paved the way for black students to attend the same schools as white students. It also ended the careers of a generation of highly qualified and credentialed black teachers and principals. Following the Brown decision, over the decades, black schools closed and black educators were uniformly displaced in the South and also the northern border states. These actions have had serious consequences for black educators and all students across the country over the years. In her book, Jim Crow's Pink Slip, The Untold Story of Black Principal and Teacher Leadership, Dr. Leslie Fenwick details the repercussions of the resistance to the Supreme Court's decision and its ongoing impact. Dr. Fenwick is Dean Emerita of the Howard University School of Education and a professor of education policy. She's also a former Harvard University visiting scholar. She served in every sector of American education and in 2020 was a finalist for U.S. Secretary of Education. Welcome, Dr. Fenwick.
Thank you for having me, Angela.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's funny, I was reading your book, and we have a very close family friend who was a school principal in Fresno, California, and I called him about this. He's from Louisiana, and he said, yeah, he was in Louisiana and basically just lost his job. And the same thing, he came out to California to work. But even so, there were so few black teachers and principals. When I grew up, I remember just being desperate for that kind of representation and not seeing people who look like me. And your book was really eye-opening. Thank you for writing it.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, there have been two responses to the book. The first response is, oh my gosh, I didn't know this story. How could I not know this story? The other response is from individuals whose family histories were affected by this story, and they, like your friend, lived in some of the southern, or as you said earlier, the northern border states. You know, this was happening from Delaware all the way down to Florida, over to Arkansas, Oklahoma, Texas, the 17 dual-system states, those states that operated racially segregated schools at the elementary the K-8 level through high school, and also through college and graduate and professional schools. And so those have been the two responses. This affected my family history. I remember one reader told me that he remembered his grandfather losing his job, and as a child he knew something was wrong but didn't know all the details. But I've heard those two responses to the book.
It's such a tragic legacy. And you open the book with a reminder that Brown versus Board of Education is not ancient history. Why is it so important to remind readers of this?
You know, we do think of Brown as 1954. That was the year that the decision came down. But there was resistance to Brown from white power structures and citizens. Well through the 1970s, even in some states until the early 1980s. And so this Brown has been living with us for a while. One of the motivations that I had to write the book is that I kept hearing in my own work and reading this also in research literature and social commentary about the underrepresentation of blacks in the teaching force, that after Brown, blacks fled the teaching professions or the education professions, teaching and the principalship, for more lucrative opportunities in other areas of the labor force. And I knew that was not the historical record, nor do U.S. Department of Labor statistics reports show that. In fact, the history that I share in the book is that the black educator pipeline was purposely decimated. And we're living with the fallout of that decimation even now. There's this tremendous demographic mismatch between the nation's public school students, the majority of whom are students of color and also students from families experiencing poverty. And so when we look at the statistics today, about 7% of the nation's 3.2 million teachers are black. About 11% of the nation's 90,000 principals are black, and less than 3% of the nation's 14,000 superintendents are black. And there's a history to this underrepresentation. One of the fallouts that we're experiencing is that we lost at least two generations of black educators who were more academically credentialed and professionally experienced than the whites who replaced them.
And you mentioned in the book, you discuss some of these educators. Can you share just some of the qualifications of the black educators versus the people that replaced them? Because that was pretty surprising.
Well, you know, the primary resource for my book is a series of U.S. Senate hearings on the displacement of black principals. And those Senate hearings, this problem was so bad that it made it to the ears of Congress. Those Senate hearings were held in 1971. And they open with then-Senator Walter Mondale, who later, as we know, became vice president, asking Dr. Betty Smith for her testimony about what happened to her in her state, Georgia. And he begins by asking her about her academic credentials and professional experiences. And she says that she is one of three principals in the state of Georgia at the time who holds a doctorate. Dr. Betty Smith had completed her undergraduate education at an HBCU, historically black college or university, because at the time, black students were restricted to black colleges, black schools, K-12, and then black colleges and graduate and professional schools. And if they wanted to earn a graduate or professional degree in a field that was not offered by an HBCU, the black citizen had to go to a state that offered an integrated educational opportunity at the graduate or professional level. And so Dr. Betty Smith, like many of her peers, went to about one of seven schools: New York University, Columbia University, the University of Pennsylvania, University of Chicago, the Ohio State, University of Michigan, Iowa, and there were a couple of others. But the schools in the book I call the black educators' trek north and Midwest and west in some cases to these preeminent institutions, and academic migration. They earned their graduate degrees at these northern and Midwestern and Western institutions and returned south to teach in segregated black schools. And so what we find overwhelmingly in the 17 dual system states that while black schools, segregated black schools, are generally perniciously underfunded, the individuals who staff those schools are more credentialed than their white peers.
Dr. Fenwick, you were talking about Betty Smith and her myriad qualifications, and she was still pushed out of her work.
Yes. So what happened in the 17 dual system states is that superintendents and mayors and state legislators, backed by the sentiment of citizens, interpreted Brown to mean the closure of all black schools. And Brown did not mean that. What Brown meant was we need to close all black schools, all white schools, and fully integrate not only the student populations, but the teachers and principals that would serve students in these newly integrated schools. So what happens is all black schools are closed. Black educators are summarily fired, dismissed, and demoted. And on a near one-to-one basis in the 17 dual system states, those black educators are replaced by whites who are lesser credentialed than they or uncredentialed. And in fact, Thurgood Marshall, who was an NAACP attorney at the time, notes the most egregious case, also in a Georgia rural school, of an African-American principal with 14 years of experience who had graduated from an HBCU and earned his master's degree at Columbia University, replaced by a milkman.
A milkman.
So our country, pardon?
A milkman?
A milkman.
Yeah.
The larger stories, though, are the stories of profoundly credentialed educators who were committed to and fighting against anti-racism by the establishment of NAACP chapters. These principals and teachers and their civic roles were also helping establish voting rights crusades and initiatives. And so one of the losses that we continue to have, I think, in public education is the loss of a credentialed body of professional educators who were never replaced. And also, I asked the reader the question, where might we be as a country had these individuals with their commitment to anti-Black racism, to voting rights, to an inclusive democracy, and also who were exceptionally academically credentialed and who had experienced integrated education in their graduate education, where might we be had they been at the forefront of integrating the nation's public schools?
No, and that's such an important question, because you look back and you even say in the book, this didn't just affect these people. It didn't just affect students. It's affected the economies. It's affected, you know, just aspects of creating wealth within Black families. And I was reading your book, and I think it was chapter 4. It opens with this vile quote by Richard Nixon: Black children aren't equal to white children. Black teachers are not as good as white teachers. And yet there's this huge body of highly credentialed, highly active, intelligent leaders in these school districts. And it just gets wiped out. I was wondering how were they going about pushing people out? Were they just firing them, or was there an excuse, or what were some of the ways of pushing these academics out of schools?
So even before the decision, as districts are waiting for the decision to come down, there are teachers and principals who are receiving letters that say, if Brown is successful, your services will no longer be needed. And I quote one of those letters in the book. That letter is a relatively well-known letter, but it certainly is not an outlier. So even before the decision, superintendents are sending Black principals and teachers these letters saying, Brown is creating a circumstance where will not need your services and your school will be closed. But if Brown does not prevail, your all-Black school will remain open, and you can continue in your teaching or principal appointment. And this was wrong. It mm-hmm. was discriminatory. It was illegal. These were educators who had played by all the rules, even the segregationist rules of when they needed to earn graduate degrees out of state doing so. So they were credentialed, they were able, they were committed, and yet they were still captured by the arc of race madness, mm-hmm. I say in the book.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You're listening to Keenest Observers. We're speaking with author and educator Leslie Fenwick. She's the author of Jim Crow's Pink Slip, The Untold Story of Black Principal and Teacher Leadership. You can join the conversations at 800-838-3760 or send emails during our broadcast to jx@jeffnet.org. There's also this idea that these educators just kind of said, oh, okay, and then walked quiet, you know, wandered away somewhere. And I'd love for you to talk about how they fought back and some of the consequences.
Chapter 4 of my book is devoted to the legal cases that the educators waged to get their jobs back. And, of course, the Herculean effort here was led by the NAACP at the time. But the NAACP had wonderful partners, the National Association for Secondary School Principals. Mm-hmm. Though that organization was predominantly white, the executive director and those members, at the urging of Black principals, came forward and said, this is wrong. We cannot use Brown to eliminate professionals who can help us integrate our nation's public schools. And so I cite the work of the NAACP in concert with the National Association of Secondary School Principals and other partners, the American Friends Service Committee, which is a Quaker organization committed to human and civil rights, the NEA, the National Education Association. These are organizations that partner with the NAACP, go to the border in southern states and do reports and bring back data about what's happening in these schools to Black educators and also Black students.
Man. Well, you focus mostly on the South and the southern border states. I'm kind of curious about the impact across the country. And we're here in Southern Oregon, and you know, I have two sons who've gone through the school system, and they have never had a Black teacher or principal or seen one. And yeah. I'm curious as to how all of this, everything that happened after Brown, kind of had a far more, spread, had a far more wide-reaching impact than I think people realized.
So today in 2022, we have 40% of our states have no teacher of color. Mm-hmm. So this is a remarkable statistic, and we know that all students benefit from diverse models of intellectual authority, because that teaches a child that all people can participate in knowledge generation, all people have creativity, all people have intellect, all people can gain subject matter expertise. So when children don't see diverse models of intellectual authority, one of the messages that gets communicated is that intellect doesn't belong to all people. Mm-hmm. And this is the largest generation of children who have not had exposure to diverse models of intellectual authority in their teachers or diverse models of school leadership in their principal or even the superintendent. So what happened in the 17 dual system states created the white resistance to the decision, to the law of the land, created schools that became white spaces, white in terms of leadership, the levers of control, superintendents, principals, teachers, even the curriculum is almost exclusively white in terms of authorship, in terms of imagery and content. And so the assertion of Jim Crow's pink slip is it didn't have to be this way. This is an unfortunate legacy that our public education system is still struggling with and our public school students must live with. We have lots of data to show that all children benefit from diversely staffed schools. And in fact, most recently, Johns Hopkins University released several reports. The National Bureau of Economic Research has shared reports from researchers around the country showing these benefits. In the case of Black students who attend highly diversely staffed schools, they're less likely to be expelled or suspended, less likely to be misplaced in special education, more likely to graduate high school in 4 years, and more likely to apply to and be accepted and attend college after high school graduation. And I could go on with this list of benefits that accrue not only to Black students, but Hispanic, Latinx, and white students. This is one of the values of the American education system and society, that diversity has value.
Thank you. Wow. You're listening to Jefferson Exchange's Keenest Observers. We're speaking with author and educator Leslie T. Fenwick. She's the author of Jim Crow's Pink Slip, The Untold Story of Black Principal and Teacher Leadership. You can still join the conversation at 800-838-3760 or send emails during the broadcast to jx@jeffnet.com. brownvsbrown.org. I was thinking about all the things that you were saying earlier, just sort of how would schools look? And I'm also realizing some of the traumas that students of color have suffered just over the years because the teacher or the principal just didn't understand or didn't see them as even fully human. I'm thinking about the over-policing of Black students in school and the more severe punishments, but also, you know, every once in a while you hear those cases of a white teacher just cutting a Black kid's hair because they don't like their hair. And nowadays, that, you know, that's still happening. And I'm wondering, could you talk about some of the obstacles for Black educators today?
Well, one obstacle is that we're still living with this history. So the pipeline was decimated, and after the decimation of the pipeline, you know, confidence about going into the profession, I think, was somewhat diminished. In other words, people lived this history, their families lived this history, and they could have been dissuaded from even thinking about the education professions. We also see some other barriers to entering the profession that particularly affect educators of color. Entrance licensure exams. I'm not talking about exit licensure exams, but pre-service teachers take licensure exams to be accepted into education programs and also to receive full teacher licensure. So we've seen that these licensure exams, the entrance licensure exams in particular, have a disparate negative impact on Black and Latinx applicants to the profession. And there's a history there, too, that is associated with the decimation of the Black educator pipeline. So prior to Brown, and even through the 70s, Black teachers and principals had superior academic credentials, more likelihood to have a master's and doctoral degree. They had higher levels of professional licensure, and larger percentages of Black teachers had licensure. And so one of the things that the states did as they were, legislators did as they were trying to dismantle the Black educator pipeline, is they collaborated with test makers to create tests that would disproportionately negatively impact Black educators. And even in those cases, Florida is one case, and I'm talking about the 1960s at this time, when Black educators still prevailed on those tests, they kept maneuvering the tests and in some cases dropped the tests when white educators did not outperform Black educators. And so we're still living with this kind of shady history behind test construction and the use of cutoff scores on these tests, which have had disproportionately negative impact on the Black educator pipeline more recently. So when we look at many things, vouchers, school choice, charter schools, the use of entrance licensure exam cutoff scores, all of these mechanisms have a history in white resistance to the Brown decision, and we haven't shaken the shackles of that history yet. And in fact, I'm not the only author who says this. There's profound research about the history of vouchers and school choice and charter schools and the use of cutoff scores for licensure exams for teachers. One of the major messages is that this history is not dead, and we're living with the fallout of it and need to recognize that as we seek solutions to diversify the educator workforce.
Oh, man, I'm always... I'm a Black woman in my 50s. I'm still flabbergasted by the amount of energy and work that was going into, that still goes into keeping these gates closed. And My last question, I just wanted to know, what can we do now, just going forward? You list some suggestions. Can you talk about that?
Well, one of the things that this history shows us is that the NAACP, with their partners that were largely white organizations, the National Association of Secondary School Principals and the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker organization committed to civil and human rights, that those interracial alliances and that work, it matters. It means something. Because white citizens can speak with a truth about some of these racial realities in ways that that are different from how black citizens speak to these issues and other citizens. So interracial alliances really matter across communities: white, black, Asian, Hispanic, Latinx, Native American. That is a real strength, and it matters. The other thing is, we just need to continue the good work. Most Americans believe in integrated schools and believe in a diverse educator workforce. And we need to highlight that message and continue good work in that direction.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. I really thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. We're speaking with Dr. Leslie T. Fenwick, author of Jim Crow's Pink Slip. Thank you.
Angela, I really appreciate the opportunity to share my book and thoughts with you today. Thanks a lot.